Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect Radio. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Colin. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and also to listeners of Unity FM 93.5 up in the Midlands and Birmingham. Our guest this week is Jan Ayres, promoter of top folk musicians and performers in the South West.
Features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Greaves reads a chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. We have a piece of prose by William Shakespeare. And of course, Jeff Sparks is back in the studio with his What Song Guide and Song of the Week. But coming up later in the show...
Well, I was in the very first episode and for the first year, and I played Linda Chavesky, and I was Elsie Tanner's daughter.
Well, we mentioned top folk musicians and performers from the South West.
And I'd like to welcome to the studio Jan Ayres. Hello.
Oh, good evening.
So you're here to discuss Bristol folk, the folk scene here, and a folk festival that you're organising. Well, what is your general assessment of folk music in Bristol at the moment?
Folk music everywhere is... It's a renaissance for folk, worldwide, UK-wide, Bristol-wide, really. And that's why we're doing the festival after 32 years of not having one.
Right, so the last time would have been, what, 1978? That calculates as, is it?
Yes, it does, yeah. And it was in a field in Hannam, and it rained and was dreadful, apparently.
So how long does your interest in folk music go back? When were you sort of first aware of it as a genre?
30 years, yeah. Really, the full length of time in the music business.
Right. And what did you start doing to become involved in the music business? What were you doing?
Nothing to do with folk. No, more then, where were we? Punk, basically. Started in all that, which again, I mean, it's fundamental. Punk's very down earth, you know, down to the earth and basic and people orientated and community orientated, and a lot of shouting, but it was a good training ground.
Okay, so do you think sort of folk is maybe a bit like that in some respects, but with less shouting?
Yes, yeah, it is. It's available, it's very available to everybody, and pick up a guitar and play, or a set of drums, or a keyboard, or a microphone and sing. It's very much community orientated.
Okay. Have you ever played yourself?
Piano?
Yeah.
Yeah, doesn't fit really.
Well, that could fit with folk. Do you sort of play?
Yes, of course it could. Yes. Yeah.
So who are big for you right now when you're going to see folk in Bristol? Who are your favourites? Or nationally, in fact?
Who do we promote more like? Yeah, we work with Seth Lakeman, who's patron, of course, for our folk festival. Bellowhead, who have just sold the Old Vic out in Bristol for the next tour. Look out for more dates with them in the city. Show of Hands, who play, Colston Hall's on sale now with them. All the big A-listers, really. And they love Bristol. And they are West Country acts. Off.
Was there sort of a build-up to you thinking, I now recognise now this is the time for a new folk festival, or was it just a sort of spur of the moment, oh, well, why not, we'll just do it?
It was a spur of the moment, yeah.
Okay, so things. How did you sort of originally foresee it? I mean, originally, I suppose it would have been in a field. Did you think about doing that?
No, because I've said for years, never again do a festival. Fields, tents, fences, rain, toilets outside, just avoid them. And then suddenly I thought, okay, Bristol doesn't have a folk festival, which was incredible in itself, that fact. And I thought, why? Well, let's go to Colston Hall, let's have a chat, let's see. And they said, within 10 minutes, they said, yes, involve us. And with that I said, right, we will turn you into a festival site.
How on earth does that work logistically? My mind is boggling. Yeah. It's places full of seats.
Oh, no, it's not. No, we'll take, it'll be standing, it'll be the standing, the auditorium will be standing, just tiered seating, and then Hall 2, of course, now, we have in Colston Hall, and that's totally standing, lots of Kayleys in there. And the foyer, the brand new foyer, Colston Hall, that will be markets and stalls and catering and all the things you'd expect if you walk onto a field site.
Okay, yeah. What about a bit of AstroTurf or fake grass? What about that?
Yeah, good plan. I like that.
Will you be able to tent there, or Is that a step too far?
Presently, we're negotiating for a campsite. We're recommending to people Baltic Wharf campsite for vans. They don't take tents, unfortunately, and we are looking for somebody who's got the right field for tents. We've also got indoor camping, and that'll be at the university.
Okay, brilliant. So what sort of bands are we to expect at the Folk Festival? What sort of mix of local and national?
Okay, good question. I'd say it's majority of this will be Southwest. Southwest is full of this sort of talent, but also we'll have international and many visitors, because we are twinned with places like Bordeaux, who have also loads of talent, and we're looking at that. I'd say it's going to be 80% southwestern Bristol input.
Yeah. What sort of big names have you got lined up to? Are you going to try and rope in?
Already contracted. However, I'm so sorry we can't mention them yet.
Oh, really? Okay. But you have got, you know, obviously you're going to try and hope to attract a lot of people who maybe like don't necessarily count themselves as sort of solid folk heads as such.
Oh, yeah. We have, again, it's a new capacity for Colston Hall. We have a 3,000 capacity for the hall over 3 days. 3,000 people a day. So everything from creches, and under fives are free anyway, and as they say, markets and Kayleys and sing-alongs. Everything you get walking around a festival site, we intend to do.
Okay, you should hand me a leaflet, actually, and quite apart from being amused by the mention of posh loos that will be available inside, Kaylids, isn't that a form of Gaelic dancing? What sort of other... Is it, will you have sort of dancing as well as the music?
Yes, yeah, we will. And we have some tasters up to Christmas in Colston Hall of many of these things, including Kaylee, a Christmas one. So people can come along and see how it all works in this particular venue. Because, of course, we are going into... The final day is May the 1st, Sunday, May the 1st. There will be maypoles, there will be dance, there will be Morris Men, and everything you get at Beltane Festival.
Okay, so how much, sort of financial backing and people do you have to get behind you to... You know, once you've thought of this idea, what on earth do you do next?
Put it on sale. And hope for the best. It should be self-funding. We are working with partners and media partners. Evening Post is one of those. There's a lot of interest locally in this succeeding. And, of course, the Colston Hall goes to trust. It goes from being council-run venue into a trust venue by next spring, which the public are being invited to at the moment to look at and apply to become a trust member, if you wish.
Okay. Do you see that as a positive step?
I see it as a step. I've no idea.
Well, you'll have to wait and see, I suppose. Well, coming up in the next few, we've got Hazy Dixie coming up at the Fiddlers in Bristol. I imagine that's going to sell extremely well. That's on Thursday the 30th of September. In fact, if it hasn't already sold out, I don't know.
No, it's not sold out. There's still tickets for it, and it's their new album tour, and they are just a brilliant party. Yeah, so come along.
Okay, and also on Thursday, if you're in Widcombe Social Club in Bath or near there, Spiers and Bowden, tell me a little bit about them. Who are they?
Spiers and Bowden. Okay. They're Bellowhead. John Bowden, John Spiers. Okay. They're stalwarts of Bellowhead. And Widcombe Social Club, great. It's in association with Bath Folk Festival, who we support. And, of course, they've had their own folk festival this summer for the first time.
Okay, so for people who don't know, what are Bellowhead like?
Bellowhead are an 11-piece collection of multi-talented musicians. They're different, they're radical, they're fun. They're on, let's see, as I say, Bristol's date sold out for their new tour in November, and that's their new album, which is called Hedonism, which says it all about Bellowhead.
On Wednesday the 6th of October at the Louisiana in Bristol, Michael Weston King will be playing. What sort of folk is he?
Right, well, Michael Weston King, that is a revolution. I mean, it is a protest night, it's an anti-war protest album by him, album tour, and he's very loudly saying, who's singing protest songs these days? De Coldplay, as he said recently. Who's singing them? I am. And that's what particularly what that gig's about.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I can definitely see a crossover with sort of a punk attitude there, definitely, as well. Thursday, the 21st of October, Gloucester Cathedral, a little further out, Show of Hands with Miranda Sykes. What sort of genre of stuff is that?
Right, Show of Hands, again, Devonshire's finest duo, Miranda Sykes, now residing in Bath, actually, Miranda, double bassist, always with Show of Hands on tour. And this is their Spires and Beams tour, the cathedrals and churches they do once a year. They're also doing Wells Cathedral. And it's a unique show, particularly for that sort of venue.
Okay, so it's sort of ecclesiastical in theme, generally, okay.
Yeah.
And Hot Club of Cowtown last week. It's Thursday, 28th of October, at the Fiddlers in Bristol down the road as well. What are they like?
Okay, well, that is a crossover into Americana. They are American. They went down so well in Bristol last year, they specifically requested to come back to the city on this album tour.
Okay, brilliant. Well, to recap, I mean, Bristol Folk Festival is quite a way off, Friday the 29th of April to Sunday the 1st of May. So you can't say you've not been planning well in advance. And that's at the Colston Hall and the new foyer, which is the place that looks like the gigantic gold brick.
Yeah, but it's better inside.
Better inside, okay. And if you want to find out more, you can visit the website bristolfolkfestival.com. And the box office for Colston Hall is 0117 922 3686. Well, Jan Ayres, thank you very much for allowing us to interview you, and we hope it all goes very well for you.
Thank you indeed.
And indeed, thank you very much to Jan Ayres there. Let's follow that up with a folk music theme track by Seth Lakeman from his new single, Tiny World.
Our next feature is by Tony Gosling, and he's speaking to Julian Lee Jones from the Temple Local History Group. Now, Bristol has one of the richest heritages of local history of any city in Europe, and in the 1980s, the Temple Local History Group began. Engineer, historian and author Julian Lee Jones is author of the fascinating book Bristol Curiosities. Dialect's Tony Gosling continues his conversations with Julian about Bristol's hidden history, and this week Julian talks about Bristol street names and how he came to be asked to write his book Bristol Curiosities.
We had a book, and it was Sketchley, who was an auctioneer and printer down in the town. small street, I think it was, in the late 1700s, third quarter, 1775, something like that. He put together a street directory, sketched his street directory, and it was in name order. And he reputedly came up with the idea of numbering houses, because up to that time, you didn't have postal deliveries per se. And communities were small enough that you knew that Mr. House was adjacent to so-and-so, or next door to this, or behind that, or whatever. And he came up with the idea, when he did his directory, he suddenly realised he needed some systematic arrangement, so that if you put his directory in alphabetical name order, you had to actually say where people lived. So the story is that he actually sold for, I don't know, I've been quoted a price of sixpence, I think, to actually have people's house number, the new house number, put in the directory. And this is quite a valuable tool, the 1775 directory, for historians and researchers. But unfortunately, it is only in name order, and so you've got to plod through. And one of the things that we did, and this is a good example for why you should join a larger group if you're forming a research association, is that we actually went through and pulled out addresses from his directory that interested us in and around Temple Street, because we were looking at the population of Temple Street and how it changed. And we had a member join us, very sad case, that he came to us very proudly, he'd spent 18 months translating this into street order rather than alphabetical order. We had the very distressing job of actually pointing out to him that in 1911, a Mr. Jackson in Horfield, there was a newspaper, local newspaper, Horfield and Bishopston, the Horfield and Bishopston Record, and he had actually done this. And so this poor chap had spent 18 months, a completely nugatory task. But the thing is, this didn't exist anymore. We couldn't get fine copies. And so one of the things we did, again, as a benefit for our members, and then we went through and we transcribed and did some updates on Mr. W.F. Jackson, 1911, rearrangement of Sketchley's directory. But what we also did, we looked through other back directories, Matthews and earlier ones, because we found that when people were doing research, they found quite often on certificates and things, it wouldn't say somebody lived in Temple Street at number 70 or anything else. The large mass of the population, certainly down in the old part of the city, lived in little squares, tenements, courtyards, where they were jam-packed in. I mean, for example, one of our favourite ones is somebody came to us and had on a certificate, this ancestor lived in Quiet Woman's Entry. And Quiet Woman's Entry, we discovered, was off Temple Street. It's one of these courts. So what we did, we added value to Mr. Jackson's directory by including a whole series of these other places saying where they were. I mean, Lamb Street's off College Street, for example, and all these other ones. Wellington Terrace is off near Harford's Bridge. But Quiet Woman's Entry was quite a nice one.
Bringing us up to date a little bit, your book, Bristol Curiosities, I mean, is there any sort of theme connecting the various things you found in there?
Yes, Bristol Curiosities was a commission book. What happened was Berlin, the publishers, they were doing a series around the country of Bath Curiosities, which they'd done a couple of years prior and working around, and they approached me and asked me if I would do a book on Bristol Curiosities. The content was really up to me. So we've now jumped from a sort of a 30-page pamphlets up to a 200-and-something-odd page book, which is 25 chapters. And it was 6 months of really hard work. But what it did, we realised that after 20, 25-odd years of research project, we had an awful lot of research projects which we'd done all the field work and then the results were just languishing. So you weren't really benefiting anybody other than those in the know. So it seemed sensible to use the opportunity to actually finish writing up a lot of these projects and close them off and publish them. The bad news was, if you write a book on your own account like this, you have the typical sort of image of the author in his garret sort of slaving away and having publishers, rejection after rejection, the alternative is to have a book commissioned like this, where you have the publisher's Damoclean sword hung over your head. In this case, it was particularly telling because when I had two chapters still to write, I found out it was being advertised second-hand on Amazon.
That was Julian Lee Jones there talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling and reminding us how easily we seem to forget our local heritage. More from Julian next week. If you want to find out more about the Temple Local History Group, the website is history4u, that's the number 4.info.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Okie dokie, our next feature is by Anthea Page. It's an interview with Noel Tovey at the Edinburgh Fringe, and it's about his life growing up as an Aboriginal in Australia. But first, we're going to hear some music of Aboriginal didgeridoo style. This track is called Sunrise Over Uluru, and is better known to Europeans as Ayers Rock.
I'm in the coffee bar now at the Gilded Balloon, one of the venues at the Edinburgh Fringe. And yesterday I went to see a show called A Little Black...
Illegitimate Child.
Yeah. Didn't want to say the actual word. And I'm here with the actor who did the monologue. Can you tell us about your show?
My name's Noel Tovey, and the play is based on my autobiography, which was published in 2004. And it's about my early formative years growing up in Australia when I'm part of what's called in Australia the stolen generation. There was a law that said if you had mixed black and white blood, the government could take you away.
I think a lot of British audiences are familiar with this because of Rabbit Poo Fence.
Yeah. Yes, and I know that girl. Oh, yeah, both of them actually, yeah. Very well, yeah. And so in the year 2000, I received the Commonwealth of Australia Fellowship to write my autobiography. This was a result of writing it, really. It was a bit difficult at first because I've had no formal education. And I took a tram ride. And I took a tram ride in the early morning and went right through my childhood. And when I got off the tram and I bought a notebook and wrote down the memory. I'm Aboriginal African. Well, let me start at the beginning. On my mother's side, I'm Aboriginal and Scottish. And on my father's side, I'm African and English.
That's quite a mixture, isn't it?
It is quite a mixture.
So yours was a rags-to-riches story, in a sense, because you had a very cruel upbringing, and then you've made it all the way to the top. Tell us a little bit about your background.
I knew by 1960 that I would have to leave Australia if I was going to have a career. And I'd studied dancing and singing in Melbourne, but I came to England, and I lived here for 30 years. In fact, I worked in Edinburgh quite often. I eventually became principal dancer with the Sadler's Wells Opera Ballet, and then I went on to become a director and choreographer in the West End, and choreographer in Edinburgh at the Royal Lyceum, and director at the Royal Lyceum. And I literally stayed away from Australia for 30 years.
Have you gone back there now?
Yeah, I've been home now for 20 years. It's part of my Aboriginal culture. For one thing, a lot of people were very kind to me when I was first making it in Australia. And so part of my culture is that I can't die or go to my dream time or dreaming until I've paid back, until I've repaid.
Tell us about the problem with the Aborigines in Australia, because it hasn't gone away, has it?
No, it hasn't gone away. It's going away. I mean, You know, now it's possible to go to school, and it's, you know, when I was a little boy, Aboriginals, you couldn't go to school, and in fact we weren't even citizens of our own country until the referendum in the 60s.
Do you still think there's a lot of prejudice, though, and that there's still the underclass, the Aborigines?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yes, and it's going to, it's a generational thing. It's going to take at least two or three generations.
Do you think there's a lot of guilt involved? Because the white people did steal all the land away from the Aborigines, like they did in America from the Indians. Yeah.
Well, there is a lot of guilt, dare I say it, but the British were the main perpetrators of the early crimes against the Aboriginals. Ignorance, I think, possibly, and this thing about, you know, white imperialists and all of that. But there's still a great deal of racism in Australia. Fortunately for Aboriginals now, there are so many other nationalities as well, Asians particularly, and but the Aboriginals are still the bottom of the pecking order.
Your early life was very cruel, very horrific. What was the main factor that got you away from all that and into dancing? Who was the person who influenced you most in your life?
Me. I believe that, well, that night in jail when I tried to commit suicide and I heard the voices of my ancestors telling me not to do it. And they promised me if I didn't do it, I'd find a better life. And I didn't do it, and I worked hard, and I did find a better life. But I believed in myself. I always believed that I had the ability to do something if I was given the opportunity.
I think the most chilling thing in the play was when you were in your cell and you could hear them testing the trap. And that must have been horrendous. When did they abolish hanging in Australia?
I don't know when they abolished it totally, but that woman that they hung that night that I heard was the last female to be hanged in Australia, and that was 1951.
So you've come a long way since then. What are you doing now, apart from Edinburgh?
I finished the second volume of my autobiography, which is called And Then I Found Me. It goes on about how I, you know, how I searched and so on. I'm now 76, you know. And then I'm doing a new production of a play by Genet called The Maids in Melbourne next year. And I now take it a bit easier than I did.
You're doing the play and you've written a book. Do you think there'll be a film about your life?
I've had approaches from Film Australia. Film Australia have made a documentary about my life and now they want to develop that into a feature film. Just before I left Australia, I received a Lifetime Achievement Award and I've received a Queen Elizabeth Silver Jubilee Award. I was the artistic director for the official welcome ceremony for the Olympic Games in Sydney in 2000. So I've really achieved more than I ever dreamed I would.
Do you think your story is an inspiration to Aborigines?
Strange you should ask me that question, because I've had, it is very inspirational for them. But I've had hundreds, literally more than hundreds, of letters from predominantly non-Aboriginal people saying how... In fact, one letter I had was from a young man who said, you know, he saw my play and read my book and he'd given up drinking. All the letters are about how my book or my life inspired them. You know, if I can do it, so can they.
That must be one of the most satisfying things for you.
Well, that's why I wrote it, really. I wrote it for young people so that anyone who felt that they couldn't achieve, you know, could.
The most amazing thing I found when listening to your play was the fact that you kept slipping back into trouble, but you never gave up. You just kept going. It's almost like once you got one step forward, it was two steps back, but it never deterred you from reaching the dream.
In the preface to my autobiography, I use the tram ride that I use in the play as a metaphor for my life. And I say falling off wasn't important, getting back on was.
Tying in with Jan Ayres, there's Ayres Rock and Music About It. That was Noel Tovey at the Edinburgh Fringe talking to Anthea Page. Thank you to them both. Still at the Fringe Festival, this next song was written and composed by the girls of Redland High School in Bristol. They took their play, The Trojan Women, up to Edinburgh, and this is one of the songs from their show.
To the green. gates was left a towering horse, with bridle gold and flanks of solid pine. We cried out from the citadel up high, bring that sacred offering to the shrine. Sing all the tale of Troy, a city lost in time, destroyed in one night. Sing all the tale of Troy, a city conquered in its prime. Out from their houses they came young and old, with hopes of freedom and victory foretold. To make the goddess a gift of war, bring that sacred offering to the door. Sing all the tale of Troy, a city lost in time, destroyed in one night. Sing all the tale of Troy, a city conquered in its prime. Pulling on ropes that are cull, with loops of cord they pulled it in. Pulling on ropes that are cull, with loops of cord they pulled it in. And set it on that floor. Sing all the tale of Troy, a city lost in time, destroyed in one night. Sing all the tale of Troy, a city conquered in its prime.
When a shriek of death rose through the street, as from their ambush came the Greeks. No man left to defend, and thus the tale of Troy did come slow.
And that was a song from Trojan Women. Thank you very much to the Redland High School girls.
Now we have Malcolm Greaves reading another instalment of Secrets and Lies.
Secrets and Lies, Found Under the Carpet by David Southwell. The reason why some secrets can remain hidden in plain sight, and certain blatant lies can be told and believed freely, is that the institutions concerned are so trusted that they are rarely given any real scrutiny. The institutions that control so much of our lives and dominate global culture are treated with respect, and rarely have their motives doubted. Lucky for them, as when you start digging, it becomes clear they are already working overtime to keep their cloak-and-dagger activities hidden. As children, we receive by osmosis widespread beliefs such as the paper money in your pocket is real money, that the police always enforce the law, and that museums are places dedicated to spreading knowledge. We have all been shaped by society to believe in a handful of organisations that have a huge impact on our financial, spiritual and cultural lives. The underlying reasons for their existence, or basic questions about whether they serve the public interest, are rarely asked. Those who do question them often end up perpetuating their own lies. The belief that every institution is part of a conspiracy is a lie many have bought into. The resulting level of paranoia blinds them from the truth that most cover-ups often conceal cock-ups, rather than grand, evil plans. Ultimately, our most important institutions only lie and repress information out of fear of us. They don't want us to know the truth because their biggest secret is that they only have power over us because we allow them to have it. In the event of an invasion of Britain or a mass uprising of the English people, the royal family has no plans to show bravery or face the music. They intend to make a quick getaway and escape to exile in Canada. If the brutal honesty of the above shocks anyone who clings to images of the royal family defying the Luftwaffe by staying at Buckingham Palace during the Blitz, maybe you will feel less shocked if I also tell you that this cosy myth was simply wartime propaganda, and the Windsor family regularly took refuge in a secret government bunker in Curzon Street in Mayfair. If the evacuation of the Queen and any other members of the royal family by road is impossible, or a speedier exit is required, the plan is to airlift them using helicopters. If the helicopters might be vulnerable to surface-to-air missiles, then any fleeing royals will use the secret tunnels that link Buckingham Palace to various points under the streets of central London in a vast government network of bunkers and buildings. Once in the tunnel, the Queen could travel to the Wellington Barracks, continue on to Horseferry Road Rotunda, or emerge at St James's Park Tube Station. It is more likely that she would enter the tunnel that runs under the Mall to a massive underground citadel known as Kew Whitehall. Investigative journalist Duncan Campbell, who discovered that it lies 100 feet under Westminster and Whitehall and extends as far north as Holborn, explored this vast complex of linked buildings. In 1992, a £100 million nuclear bunker and computer centre was added to the complex, with tunnels linking it directly to Downing Street and indirectly to the Buckingham Palace rat routes. The one secret I cannot tell you about the Queen's escape plans is which picture she intends to take off the Buckingham Palace walls and into exile with her. My acquaintance, who was once told by the Queen which one she intended to grab in case of emergency, cannot remember if it was one of her Rubens or Van Dyck's. Despite the fact that the 7th President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, abolished the Bank of the United States in 1833, and the US showed it could do very well without any other privately owned institution issuing currency, in 1913, Congress passed the Owen Glass Act and created the Federal Reserve, known as the Fed. Acting as the central bank of the United States, unlike many other central banks across the world, the Federal Reserve is a quasi-privately owned bank, which has assumed a monopoly position in terms of issuing the money that the people of America carry in their wallets. It is the Fed, and not the US government, that issues banknotes. According to Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution, it is forbidden to coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. In 1982, the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals ruled that the Federal Reserve banks are independent, privately owned, and locally controlled corporations. If they put out banknotes that cannot be redeemed for silver and gold, those notes are illegal under the Constitution. This wasn't a problem in 1914 when the Fed issued its first notes, as they stated on them, "This note is redeemable in gold on demand." It was not a problem in 1950, when the text on banknotes was revised to, "This note is redeemable in lawful money," because, as defined by the US Constitution itself, lawful money must only be made of gold or silver. In 1963, President Kennedy signed Executive Order No. 11,210, which issued $5 billion of currency directly from the US Mint and bypassed the Fed. These notes could be redeemed for silver and gold. However, after Kennedy's assassination, President Johnson recalled these notes and the Fed changed the text on its notes yet again to, "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private." The shocking truth is that all notes issued since 1964 are no longer exchangeable for gold, silver or lawful money. They are all illegal under the Constitution. It's no secret that UK policing has a long and dishonourable history of bent coppers, and it would be no challenge to catalogue the thousands of lies told by corrupt police officers. The fact that UK police regularly break the law when policing demonstrations is so woefully underreported that it can be considered a secret. Any regular demonstrator will be able to recount stories of police illegally obscuring their identity numbers, casual use of unnecessary violence, blocking access to public footpaths, and other infringements of the law. These breaches have been commonplace for decades, but in recent years, the UK police have begun to break the law regularly by illegally detaining protesters to prevent demonstrations taking place. Two good examples of this are cases in which the police have been successfully prosecuted. In 2002, 23 protesters from the Movement Against Monarchy were arrested for attempting to stage a mock execution on Tower Hill. At the time of arrest, they were having a quiet drink in a pub. The protesters subsequently took legal action against the police and won £3,500 damages each for unlawful arrest and false imprisonment. It was not an isolated example. The next year, Gloucester police stopped three coaches of protesters on their way to a demonstration against the war in Iraq. Having stopped and searched the 120 protesters, the police forced them back onto their coaches, barred the doors, and made them drive back non-stop for 3 hours under police escort, with the passengers forcibly detained on board. When the case came to court, Lord Justice May found that the police action could not be justified under either common law or the European Convention on Human Rights. Justified or not, despite denials, the police continue to use illegal detention as a protest prevention technique, so reducing to a blatant lie the claims that UK citizens are free to protest and have their human rights protected.
Thank you to Malcolm Greaves there for reading this week's Secrets and Lies. Now, Trevor and Tim, our resident poets, aren't here this week, so instead, to endorse the Celebrating Age Festival in Bristol this month, Malcolm Greaves is going to read the famous piece of prose by William Shakespeare, The Seven Ages of Man, from his play As You Like It. The Seven Ages of Man, from As You Like It, by William Shakespeare, read by Malcolm Grieve. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail, unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad, made to his mistress' eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honour, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice, turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange eventful history, his second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. Thanks very much for that, Malcolm.
Well, Coronation Street is a golden oldie this year as it celebrates its 50th year in broadcasting. Is that all? It feels like it's been going on forever. We're going to hear from Anne Cunningham now as she reminisces about her role in Corrie.
I'm Anne Cunningham.
Tell us about your days in Coronation Street.
Well, I was in the very first episode, and for the first year, and I played Linda Chavesky, and I was Elsie Tanner's daughter. Of course, we're coming up to the dreaded 50th anniversary, so I can't believe that it was me who was in it, because I'm still only 32. I've just come back from Vienna on holiday, where I've been staying with Ernst Walder, who played my husband, Ivan Chevesky. And on Thursday of this week, we'll be watching a play by Darren Little, the first start of Coronation Street, and I shall be watching it with Philip Lowry, who played my brother. So, of the 50 years, I still retain two very, very dear friends.
When did you leave Coronation Street, and why? Was it written into the plot?
I left it at the end of the first year, because I had been offered a part in a film, because Northern acting, Northern drama, was very suddenly the thing, and there was a film being made called This Sporting Life, and I'd been offered a part in that, and also I was very young, as you can realise, and I hadn't done an awful lot of other things. I hadn't done West End theatre, I hadn't done radio, I hadn't done, an awful lot of things, and I wanted to expand my theatrical career. I wasn't to know that this job, which I had taken initially, which the first contract was only for 12 weeks, because nobody knew whether it was going to be popular or not, I'd no idea that it was going to go on for 50 years. It might have changed my life if I hadn't decided to leave after 1 year. I did go back over the years for wakes and weddings, as I called them, and when I got married in my private life, we bought a house and I needed central heating put in, so I did go back for 6 weeks. My character, first of all, went at the end of the first year, we emigrated to Canada. We came back the following Christmas, just for a holiday, because when I left I had said I wanted to leave a whole year so that I could really try for other work before I starved. But I would go back after 1 year, which I did. But we went back for Christmas. And then, say, for wakes and weddings. And I finally, the last appearance I made on the street was in the 80s, about 1982 or so. Okay, when Pat Phoenix had died, in, if you could say, in real life. And so Elsie's house had to be sold in the street. So I went back for 6 weeks to sell the house. And then since the house was sold, I had no longer any claim for being back in Coronation Street, so I've never been back since.
But do you still watch it?
No. It's not the same.
Well, thank you very much to Anne Cunningham there, talking to Anthea Page. It's time to hear a little bit from Prompt Magazine. Eager-eared listeners will notice from previous weeks that we have mentioned this before. It's brought to us by the Avon Association of Drama, avondrama.org.uk, and it's just about local theatrical groups and what plays they put on. So here's what's going on. I've just opened it in the middle page, and immediately I've come across The Mooney Shapiro Songbook, a musical by Monty Norman and Julian Moore, a Playhouse production. This takes place at the Backwell Playhouse on the 29th of September through to the 2nd of October. Monty Norman, I believe, was, of course, the bloke who wrote the original James Bond theme tune, not John Barry. It's at the Backwell Playhouse at 7:30 in the evening on those nights. And if you want a ticket, ring 01275 392 936. Or you can ring a mobile number, I'll give you that as well, 07534 840 790. Other stuff coming up. We've also got The Sea by Edward Bond. That's courtesy of the Kelvin Players Theatre Company, and that's at Gloucester Road here in Bristol. It's 12th to 16th of October. We've also got The Cemetery Club by Ivan Menkel, by the Portishead Players, and stuff coming up by the Kingswood Players and the Stage Lights and more. If you want any more information on that, check out avondrama.org.uk to get your subscription to Prompt Magazine. So, it's my pleasure to introduce What's On for this week. Jeff, hello.
Hello. Good afternoon. This is a What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting on Thursday, 23rd of September, an audience with Howard Marks will be at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On Friday, 24th of September, Money Runner will be performing with support from the Old Peculiars and the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On to Song of the Week, but I decided to do something different and present Sketch of the Week. This is from The Goons Show, which began in 1951 on the BBC Home Service and featured Harry Secombe, Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan. This sketch was from the mysterious Punch Up the Conker episode, which was aired on February 1957 and is titled What Time Is It, Eccles?
Is it, Eccles?
Just a minute, I got it written down here on a piece of paper. And a nice man wrote the time down for me this morning.
Oh, then why do you carry it around with you, Eccles?
Well, if anybody asks me the time, I can show it to them.
Wait a minute, Eccles, my good man.
What is it, fellow?
It's written on this bit of paper. What is 8 o'clock, is written.
I know that, my good fellow. That's right. When I asked a fellow to write it down, it was 8 o'clock.
Well, then, supposing when somebody asks you the time, it isn't 8 o'clock.
Well, then I don't show it to them.
Well, how do you know when it's 8 o'clock?
I got it written down on a piece of paper.
I wish I could afford a piece of paper with the time written on.
Oh,
here, Echo.
Yeah?
Let me hold that piece of paper to my ear, would you? Here. This piece of paper ain't going.
What? I've been told a forgery.
No wonder it stopped at 8 o'clock.
Oh, dear.
You should get one of them things my granddad's got.
Oh?
His firm gave it to him when he retired.
Oh.
It's one of them things, what it is, that wakes you up at 8 o'clock, boils the kettle, and pours a cup of tea.
Oh, yeah. What's it called?
My grandma.
Wait a minute. How does she know when it's 8 o'clock?
She got it written down on a piece of paper.
That was The Goon Show with What Time Is It, Eccles? From the mysterious Punch Up the Conker episode. For more information, you can check out www.thegoonshow.net. Into Saturday, 25th of September, Mike Peters of the Alarm of Fame will be performing with support from Gerard Starkey and also Russell Joslin at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 26th of September, Sweet Laredo will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest, Jan Ayres, for telling us about the Bristol Folk Festival. If you stick that in Google or your favourite search engine, you will find out more. Features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and Malcolm Grieve, Red Secrets and Lies, and The Seven Ages of Man by William Shakespeare.
Jess Sparks presented the What's On Guide, and the studio engineering this week was done by Lee Duffield, with assistance by Lee Simpson and Mike Lewis, and the producer was Anthea Page. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. Have a great week.
Goodbye.
So I tried to warn her, I turned to see her.